I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University here in Fremantle. Welcome back, Martin.
It's fantastic to be here.
Martin, we were trying to work out, sort of, last week, whether the coalition was doomed or whether they were getting back together again. You were reasonably confident, I think, at the time that they would get back together again. But what do you make of it all? It seems like something of a love-in, but perhaps it isn't.
I think that the term love-in isn't certainly an overestimate of of the warmth in the room. I think you could still see from the body language there was a lot of awkwardness there. I think they're pretending to be good friends, and I guess we'll see. It's a bit like the estranged couple that turn up the son or daughter's graduation, and they've got to pretend they like each other. But everyone knows they're not really that close at the moment. So
you're speaking like an executive dean who goes to graduations, Martin.
everyone appears to like each other at graduation, Michael. So yeah, I think there's certainly a fair bit of tension underneath the surface, and it's probably been exacerbated by some of the choices on the shadow cabinet and the shadow front bench. So you're talking
that?
About
What's happened?
There's winners and losers, and in the Liberals, some of the more prominent women, ironically, despite having a women leader, Jane Hume, Sarah Henderson, and of course Jacinta and Imogena Price, have all been demoted, and I don't think any of them are very happy about it, and they're making noises, and the noises sort of coming from some of the conservative wing of the party is that they're underrepresented or not given the portfolios that they wanted. And from the Nationals, you've got Brendan, you've got both Joyce and McCormack, the two immediate past leaders who have both been demoted to the backbench. And what do you think they're going to do? Already Michael McCormack is refusing to rule out a tilt for the leadership. And when he was pressed repeatedly about the leader's choices, he just said it's prerogative of the leader, which is hardly a ringing endorsement. They're looking at a range of people with knives out ready to attack them whenever something goes wrong. It's not a healthy start to the term.
Well, there are some commentators I see, Waleed Ali amongst them, suggesting what the Nationals need is a good dose of teal, like the Libs have had, to catch up to political reality in the country. What do you make of that suggestion?
It's an interesting suggestion. They have copped it now and again. Regional independence preceded the teal-style independence, and they've got the odd one like, so there are some. So in the member for Indi, Helen Haynes, you've got Andrew G in Kalea. So they've got they've lost some seats to independence, probably not the scale that the Liberals have endured. But and the interesting thing about both those candidates, Michael, is they're reasonably socially progressive candidates. So we can't just assume that because it's a regional electorate, everyone's super conservative. There are a range of views in communities like that.
Well, if the little bubble suddenly turns into, you know, hot steam and an eruption in the coalition, where will we first see it happening?
Well, certainly, you know, there's always more pressure on the leaders when the polls are bad. So you can't ignore that political reality, the hard political reality. So if they're not making any ground over time, that's going to be like a ticking time bomb. But it might not even get that far, because I think one of the biggest debates is around the coalition continuing to commit to net zero. I think there's a lot of people in the party, particularly in the Nationals, who don't think it's a good idea. And that's a big deal. That's your overarching environment policy, and a range of other industry decisions that you take are based on that big call. So if they, that's going to come to a head at some stage.
I suppose, without going off on a complete tangent, the coalition, Nationals included, are probably being helped by the Labor Party's timidness when it comes to net zero and setting clear policy.
Well, the only thing is that Labor's kind of occupying the centre ground on these things. And so for a point of difference, you know, do they just support what the Labor Party is doing? You know, we've seen the big extension to the Woodside gas project to 2070 here. Or do they go further right to try and establish a point of difference? Certainly, if they were abandoned net zero together altogether, that would be, it's a bit like refusing to sign the Kyoto Agreement under Howard. I thought that was a really, it's not that that itself was critical. It's about what it signaled, Michael. And the fact that it signaled, their signaling to the electorate was, we're not going down this path. It was, in effect, a playing down of climate change.
Martin, we haven't for some time, because there's been so much else on state election, federal election, and other world events, talked about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, or the continuing Israeli destruction of Gaza. Can we turn to the Russian invasion of Ukraine? It seems to have really peaked again lately. And just 2 episodes ago, we were talking about the Pope, Pope Leo. We're talking about the papacy, we're talking about the Vatican as a state, and you'll be interested to hear I've been following Vatican News on their website, vaticannews.va, and the Pope on Wednesday made some statements about Ukraine, and then the Papal Nuncio was asked about it yesterday, I think, and the Papal Nuncio said the words of Pope Leo XIV about the attacks on Ukrainian cities and infrastructure, and his invitation to pray for peace are very important. And he goes on to talk about how big this war is, the attack on Kyiv, and virtually nobody could withstand what's happening there. What is happening, and where does Trump fit into all of this? Has he got any interest in the show?
Well, it does. This is, I think we have seen a really profound shift here in the last week or so. Until then, Donald Trump, it was disturbing a lot of people. He appeared to believe that Vladimir Putin wanted peace. He was skeptical at times of Zelensky, although they appeared to be getting along a little bit better of late, and they had that meeting, the famous meeting in the Vatican, one-on-one. But it just over the last week, I think he's lost patience with Vladimir Putin, and he's getting increasingly critical and personal on his social media channels, where he is prone to the odd rant, just one or two, Michael, on social media. And I think that he's starting to realize that maybe he doesn't have quite the leverage with Putin that he thought he did. He thought that because they're mates and they got along, that he would be the man that would bring peace, because he was the only guy that Putin would listen to. But Putin's biggest audience is the domestic audience in Russia. He's worried about loss of face unless he gets out of this war on his own terms. And I think he's less inclined to do Trump's bidding than Trump perhaps thought. That doesn't mean peace is impossible, but it's harder slog than Donald Trump wanted. Donald Trump wanted to simply bring the two parties together. He'd do a bit of prep work, Michael, but at the end of the day, he'd bring Zelensky and Putin together at some summit. The three of them would agree to a peace deal, and he would be the peacemaker because he's the deal maker, Michael. And it's
Well,
just proved a bit harder than he thought.
it's a lot harder, isn't it? And at the same time, of course, the battle between the EU, between the other NATO participants outside the US goes on. Keir Starmer for Britain seems to be leading some sort of a charge. Zelensky goes to Berlin and meets with the German Chancellor during the week, and that seems to have been successful in getting money or armaments. I'm not quite sure which, but what do you make of that? I don't know if it's sort of a shadow form of diplomacy that's coming from Europe. What's happening with that?
Yeah, so amidst all of that, you've got Europe coming out and offering to further support Zelensky. They're worried about US commitments there, and then giving Putin ultimatums. Now, the complexity here is that does Putin respond well to ultimatums? I'm not sure that he does. And there is probably the only grounds, like I said, that Putin is likely to make peace is where he comes out of it with enough face. So he's invested an enormous amount of resources and loss of lives. I mean, Russia's the one that's borne the most loss of lives out of all this, which speaks to the awful decision by Putin to invade. Because let's be clear, I mean, he could walk away, he could withdraw from Ukraine. Ukrainians don't have that choice. That's their own, country. They can't just withdraw from the battlefield, can they? But Russia could if they really wanted to. But they've invested so much in this now that they want an outcome that justifies that.
One gets the impression that if it's going to be a successful resistance of Putin's sort of bombasticness or militariness, that it has to be a combined strategy from the US and the rest of NATO. Do you think?
I think that get it. Yes, absolutely. And I think that's probably where the problem is. It's the German Chancellor, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, and Trump are not quite on the same page. It didn't help that JD Vance went over there and told the Europeans they don't do democracy well. some of these fault lines that were established early during the second Trump presidency probably haven't helped. But they do need a common approach at NATO to have any chance of finding peace, I believe.
The Russians have tried to make it seem it's not just Putin and there are other Russians in the leadership. One of the senior leaders responded to one of the Trump missives the other day by reminding them that do they really want war, sort of thing. I mean, that threat is there, isn't it? It sounds like a nuclear threat when I read it.
Look, whether that eventuates or not, I'm not entirely sure, but it does represent an escalation in the rhetoric, at least, doesn't it? So that's the part that concerns us. I mean, I've got no problem with Donald Trump's broad approach to peace, as in he should be trying to bring those parties together, and he should be trying to organise an agreement. I think that a lot of people are sceptical, though, of Putin's real desire for peace. Probably more skeptical than he was. Maybe he's starting to share their view now. And secondly, that a deal can be found which offers Ukraine enough securities, because if you're just having peace, you're giving Russia a good part of their land and there's no security guarantees. Where will we be in another 10 years' time?
It'd be interesting, Martin, I haven't tried to do it yet, to go back to our earliest discussions about the Russian invasion, to see just what we predicted. Did we put down any time frames? I suspect we didn't. We knew it was drawing out, but would you make any predictions? Is there a more probable, more likely than not path forward to some sort of resolution at the moment?
I think there is a resolution. Certainly, Zelensky kind of has to do what the US president wants him to do, because despite the noise from Europe, the vast majority of aid and military support, and even the personal security protection for Zelensky, is provided by the US. So we might wonder why the Zelensky hasn't been knocked off by the Russians. The US are looking after him at the moment. So underneath Trump's rhetoric, there's still US support that's substantial there. So he's got a lot of leverage over Zelensky. I don't know if he's got the leverage over Putin that he thought, and I think that's where the dilemma is. But the other thing that brings Putin to the table, or should, is the enormous loss of life, the significant sanctions that the country is facing, and the economic problems that have emanated from that war. So it has been a problem for Putin. It's a very messy situation for him as well. Even if he doesn't care at all about the lives loss, he will care about the having to explain this to the Russian public.
Well, perhaps on this particular topic, I can finish with the words of the papal nuncio, who is an archbishop who's got the special job of doing it, Archbishop Kilbokas. He finished off when he was questioned at this press conference by saying, "Recently, we have even witnessed in the capital, Kyiv, continuous bombings every day, every night. No army in the world will be able to defend itself from such intense attacks. Faced with this reality, where no one is able to fully protect life, cities, or infrastructure, the Pope's appeal is to pray for peace." I suppose there really is not much else you can do at the moment. Martin, if you're a simple human being like me, less so you who study these things.
Oh, we're all simple in many ways, Michael. I think that there's some poignant words there, and that what we've seen early days from Pope Leo is that he'd like to be a peacemaker, and I think he's not so much about stating the terms or openly, on social media, a bit like Donald Trump is, but I think he would be very happy to be a forum for peace and host peace talks at the Vatican. And it just might be that that ends up being a suitable forum for this.
Well, the other great and continuing dispute, invasion, really it's a process of elimination. The Israeli destruction of Gaza, I call it goes on and on, Martin, and it just seems terrible. The idea that by criticizing what Israel are doing is anti-Semitic is complete nonsense. Leading governments in Europe are seriously complaining about what's happening to Israel and proposing all sorts of embargoes. The Australian government seems to have been very slow to react, with a lot of pressure on them. Is Trump actually trying to back up Netanyahu, or is it being subtly withdrawn that American support? And where should Australia be in all of this?
There's been some subtle developments in this conflict of late. I think that the Israeli government is getting more isolated than it was previously, and certainly the blocking of aid going into Gaza has particularly horrified many world leaders, and our government has spoken out about that, perhaps a bit more vociferously than it has in the past. Trump's role in this is really interesting because, of course, on the one hand, he entered the presidency as great mates with Netanyahu and said a number of things which were incredibly hard-hearted. So he was going to, kick the remember he was going to kick the Gazans out and redevelop Gaza as some
A
kind of
golf course or something.
seaside resort. And people just go, "What the hell are you talking about?" But he is also, because he sees himself as a deal maker, he's got his officials trying to cut a deal with Iran. He's over in Saudi Arabia. He's recognized the new leader of Syria. And all of this appears to be done without Netanyahu in the picture. And I think the Israeli PM is a bit nervous and toey, perhaps, because if Donald Trump, who sees lots of economic opportunities, particularly for himself in the Middle East, starts, cozying up to other Middle Eastern leaders, that will make him a bit, that's a bit of a worry for Netanyahu in a way. And we have seen just in the last 24 hours a new peace deal from the US that's gone to Hamas for their consideration, apparently has Israeli support. I don't know the full details of that, but that's the real answer here. Whether it's that peace deal, I don't mean that particular peace deal, I don't know what's in it, but a peace deal, a lasting peace deal, is the real answer here, because it involves a reprieve, hopefully a permanent and ongoing reprieve, for the people of Gaza who've just been suffering the most under this, and the return of Israeli hostages. You see, you feel for those families too, but actually, you need a peace agreement that lasts. And that's happening in an environment where there's no sense of trust between the parties. So it's not an easy thing to achieve, but that's the best hope.
We've touched on it in the past, Martin, as to what a resolution, a settlement, a peace deal could look like. It has to start out with recognition of the Palestinians, doesn't it? Then that's a question of who governs the Palestinians. Is it Hamas or some new organisation? Does Hamas rebrand itself as the Palestinian Golf Course Authority or something to try and achieve American support? How do you rebuild the place? Where does international support come from? And what would Israel want? Would they want to build armaments all the way along the Gaza Strip?
They're very poignant questions. They don't have an easy answer to those, Michael. I would imagine Israel's very reluctant to accept any peace deal that sees Hamas retain control of Gaza. So I think that's likely to be a sticking point in negotiations. But if that is a sticking point, then what goes in its place? And is Hamas really gone, or is it sitting in air and waiting? You read about this, and there's not really Hamas fighters on the streets. But when there's a peace deal, they re-emerge. So they're not openly fighting so much because it's overwhelming firepower from Israel. This is an asymmetric conflict. This is not two equal sides fighting one another, which is why that scale of devastation is so huge. But once there's a peace deal, what happens next? That's very much unresolved. There's perhaps a role for other Arab states to jump in and lead. I find it difficult to believe there's a solution without, Saudi Arabia and a number of other countries getting involved.
Martin, once upon a time, when I was a boy, but perhaps not even then, the idea of the United Nations coming to help out, as they have done or attempted to do, usually with great criticism because they rely on member states giving them people wearing blue helmets and hoping they all behave and need their spines strengthened sometimes. I mean, is the UN a body we should be talking about? We haven't really talked about it much at all. Is it dead and gone?
Well, it's certainly in a tough position, in an impossible position. The UN is a well-meaning organization that's in completely hamstrung because it's totally reliant on member states. And when member states are behaving poorly, what does the UN do? The UN has very little ability to defy them. It doesn't have its own. It's never, it's occasionally has a peacekeeping force, but that's drawn from member states anyway. And in this case, they were trying to run an aid organisation. They're accused of not just bias, but infiltration by Hamas, etc. The Israeli government doesn't want to deal with them. They're seeing the humanitarian catastrophe unfold and get worse and worse and worse in Gaza, and they're kind of unable to do anything about it. And it's these situations that lead to great scepticism of the UN, and I understand that skepticism, but probably having a UN is the second worst option. Not having a UN is the worst option. So it wouldn't be any better without a UN.
Well, Martin, it seems that we will have to keep our eyes closely fixed on what's happening in Gaza. Are you expecting a little more, what I would call, gumption from the Australian government in both their words and their deeds in relation to Israel and Gaza?
Well, they certainly did up their rhetoric around the blocking of aid into the Gaza Strip. I think that was an elevated rhetoric. I think they're still trying to walk that fine line between all stakeholders and parties. But certainly, people in Europe, certainly those countries in Europe, have been much more outspoken about. And bear in mind, with a country like France has a very significant Muslim population. So there's a lot of people in France in particular that are particularly upset and distraught about the situation.
Well, as I said at the outset, I think these major events, more activity in Ukraine, continued activity in Gaza at higher levels, and of course, the getting back together again at the coalition in Canberra have distracted us from perhaps the one thing we should be talking about at great length, Martin, Australian economic policy. I promised it last week, but we haven't got there yet.
I'm still coming, and when it comes, it'll be worth the wait.
Well, we'll pencil it in for next week, Martin. But the trouble is, a week can be a very long time in politics.
You never know what's around the corner. That's part of the fun, I think.
See you next week,
Even if some of the stories can be bleak.
Martin. See you next week.
Take care.